One and a two, and welcome to the Tales from the Long Box podcast. This is episode 59. Oh, now I'm like not sure all of a sudden. God, I hate that.
Nine.
It is 59. Okay. A conversation with Joshua Dysart. I said that right, I hope.
Yeah, that's great.
Perfect. Okay, good. That's him there, but we'll get to that. I am Chris Mosby.
I'm Caleb Gerard.
And I'm Murray Fox.
And today we'll be talking with Joshua Dysart about how he, got started in comics and what he's working on and things he, people he hates in the industry. He's already told us one.
I hate anyone. I'm full of love and light. It's disgusting.
I was just kidding. No. So anyway,
Josh actually pukes love. It's really interesting.
Oh, wow, I puke love. It's really pretty, actually.
So you're like the opposite of a Red Lantern, then, and you puke out like flowers and stuff, or?
That's right. Yeah, puppies, kittens, pandas.
Yeah,
animals. I puke a lot of animals.
Unicorns,
and yeah.
No way, the horn gets stuck in my throat. It's not cool, actually. That's not.
Imagine you'd have to probably have somebody hit you on the back or something.
That's right, the Heimlich, the unicorn Heimlich, sure.
Love Heimlich, lovely.
I actually had to use it on my mom once. It was quite scary.
The Love Heimlich?
The Love Heimlich? That's gross.
Not the Love Heimlich, but the Heimlich. You know what I'm saying.
Anyway. He was also choking on a unicorn.
So. Yeah. She might have been, actually. Anyway, let's get this going.
And yes, we are recording.
Yes, we are.
Nice.
So, Caleb, I believe you said that you and Joshua know each other.
Yeah, way back when I had the pleasure of meeting Josh in L.A. He was an incredibly gracious guy. I mean, he managed. Nice. You were, dude. I mean, I don't know if you still are, but you were then. we were at some mass signing outside of some comic book store. I don't remember which one. Maybe it wasn't Comic Bug. It was like the precursor to Comic Bug, I think. I was there with my buddies. We had just done this anthology, and he invited me to come by their studio where he was working on with Hurricane Comics on Violent Messiahs, and I did. And I've stayed, mostly in touch with him over the years since then, just sort of watching in awe and cool. Jealousy at his, continuing to be a part of the industry. I mean, it's been cool to watch.
Yeah,
that was a long time ago, Caleb, man.
It was pre-kid, so at least wow. 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah, see, Violent Messiahs. Yeah, I see that. Did you say Violent Messiahs? That was what he's working on? Yeah.
Yep.
And we were all living in the same apartment. It was the worst, you probably didn't notice this because I'm so, gracious. But... that was like the worst time of my life, man. We all lived in the same apartment. We were all putting out this comic book. We were constantly at each other's throats.
Oh, I bet. Oh, man, I bet.
It was crazy, but I'm really glad I did it. The whole reason why I'm still here today and I have this career is because of that comic, so.
Yeah.
So I vaguely remember some of the story behind that. You met Jan... I could be just like, this could be a drug-induced memory, but you were living on a beach or something like that when you met Jan?
I'm sorry, say that again? What was that?
You were living on a beach or something like that when you met Jan?
Well, that's a slight conflation, but basically I had met Jan in L.A. I moved out to L.A. years and years ago. I turned 21 out here, and then which was a very long time ago, and I... And then I had gone back to Texas to be with my daughter and all this stuff and Jan Jan wanted me to help her write this comic book or actually to write the comic book with this man that she'd just fallen in love with, Bill O'Neill, who was a comic book artist, which is not something I recommend, falling in love with a comic book artist, but I was busy because I went to go live down in Mexico for a year. I lived on a beach in Mexico, which I think you're referring to. And
I knew there was a beach somewhere in the story.
It was definitely a beach. Yeah. I spent a lot of time kind of close to the Belize border, and then I came back up, and I was so dead broke that I had to take this job that Jan and Bill were offering. Which wasn't a lot of money, and I very quickly sort of, I feel a little bad about this now, but I sort of stole Bill's initial idea because I didn't really care for it so much. So I just kept changing it, assuming they would eventually not, you know, let me. But they didn't. And I ended up with a title on the top of the page, and that was it, man. And then I, you know, and then we got optioned by Madonna's company, and I moved out here.
Wow.
That's for a movie on the first comic I wrote, and so I thought, well, this is easy. It's a lot like losing your virginity. You know, you lose your virginity at whatever age, and you figure, now I'm a man, I'm going to get laid every night, and then it's like 6 years before you get laid again, and that's kind of how it was with that that first success.
Well, okay. That's probably, I mean, that's a good, sounds like a good analogy, though.
Yeah, but yeah.
It wasn't you just doing Violent Messiahs and then just then nothing else happened in the meantime, though, right?
Right. We kept making comic books, and then I moved out to L.A. in 98. We did our first Violent Messiahs in 96, the black and white one. Mm-hmm. And then I moved out to L.A. in 98, and then we kept working on it, and I was living on Jan's couch, actually.
Wow.
It was tough, man. I mean, I was essentially homeless for a while, and then I was, I mean, I high class homeless. Let's not overemphasize this.
Wasn't it Studio City or Hollywood? I don't remember.
Oh, okay. Yeah, all right.
Exactly. It was in North Hollywood, and I
put my Kleenex back then.
Yeah, precisely. And then I ended up actually becoming a professional house sitter for people, a large part for people with pets with special needs. So I ended up not paying rent for my first 4 years in LA.
Jeez.
Yeah, and I think that's another. I couldn't be a writer today. If I had gone out and had to gotten a real job and made ends meet, I don't think I would have done it. I wouldn't have put in the extra time, you know. So, because I'm lazy, basically. So that was it. And I lived on their couch, and we made this comic. And then in 2000, I got my first paying gig from another publisher, which was from Chaos Comics, if you guys remember that. So.
Yep. I was just looking at your ComicDB stint, and I think I actually have a trade paperback of Conan that you wrote that I have not quite read yet.
Nice. Well, don't read it. Just assume it's brilliant.
Okay. Well, it's packed up, and I can't find it anyway, so don't worry about it.
What's important is that you bought it. That's all.
Yeah,
that
I did. I don't know. I don't think I paid full price for it, but I did buy it.
Somebody paid full price for it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So what was the book from Chaos?
So I was brought on to write Purgatory, spelled with an I instead of a Y. And I did that for several issues. And then at that point, I don't know if you guys are too familiar with the history of Chaos, but it started to really go downhill fast. We were having trouble getting paid. And Brian Polito, who's not a bad guy, if you ask me, but there are a lot of people, I guess, who would suggest otherwise. But Brian,
yes,
you know.
That's the creator of Lady Evil, Death, right?
Yeah, Lady Death, Evil Ernie, Purgatory, Bad Kitty. Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot. I wrote some Bad Kitties, too. Those are forgettable.
Yeah, I see it. Bad Kitty Reloaded, 2000. Okay.
What's the year on it? 2002?
2001 is what it says in comic to me.
No, that's right. That's right. That site is actually surprisingly accurate. So that's it. So I worked for Chaos for a while, and then the bottom started to fall out, and then Brian asked me to write an Evil Ernie screenplay, and he was offering me so little money, and there was also the potential of not getting paid at that point. Mm-hmm. So I actually wrote the screenplay in 3 days.
Nice.
And if you ever get a chance to read it, which you won't, because it's locked in my vault, I won't let anybody see it. It looks like it in 3 days. It reads terribly. And that was it, though. Then I got a job at Penny Farthing Press, and then DC, and then Dark Horse, and that's how it starts, you know.
Yeah. So, I see you also. Oh, wait,
you were able to power out a script in 3 days. I mean, I realize you're not proud of the end result, but that you're able to put together an hour and a half of screen time in 3 days. That is impressive.
It is, actually.
Thanks, man. It's one of there are only two moments in my life where I wrote so intensively over such a short period of time that I became ill, and that's one of them. So,
yeah, I can see that. I kind of know what you're talking about there. That's not fun.
Yeah. I don't do that anymore.
Yeah. I was also seeing you. Okay, now. couple of things that were kind of big. You, Avril Lavigne makes five wishes you got in there. Is that how you say it?
Avril Lavigne, yeah.
And then you got the Neil Young.
Yeah.
Avril Lavigne, she's totally Canadian.
Yeah. He made a graphic. Wrote two volumes graphic novel based on her songs. I was reading that on Wikipedia about you, actually.
Well, you know what's funny about that is it's not actually based on her songs. I've never made it all the way through an Avril Lavigne song.
Well, yeah.
You would not be alone in that.
I this publisher approached me. The real reason was because my friend Camila DiRico was commissioned due to the art, and she...
Oh, okay. Yeah, I see that now.
Yeah, and she had contacted me along with the publisher, a Canadian publisher, and I really did it for Cammy and Camila, and I did it because I really like the people at this publishing house. But what's funny is that's the second time in my life where I just slammed something out as fast as I possibly could.
Go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. I was just saying I'm surprisingly proud of that project, despite the fact that, you know, can't stand Avril Lavigne.
Well, and it says here in Wikipedia that that book has been printed in over 7 languages as well as digitally distributed throughout Asia.
Wow, that sounds awesome. I don't recall seeing any money from any of that.
No, of course not.
They did pay me up front quite a bit of money, actually. So.
Well, yeah.
She's huge in Germany, right?
Yeah. She's also really – I know that we were aiming for the Asian market because at that time she was supposed to be really, really big in Asia. So, yeah.
Let's see. Also, your comic books were included in packaging for both the Age of Conan, Hyperion Adventures MMO from Funcom, and the Hellboy video game from Konami. Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wait.
Probably didn't get paid for that either, though.
I didn't know. I didn't get paid. I mean, I got paid to execute those comics.
First ones, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But I didn't get any back end on any of that stuff.
Yeah, that's usually the way it works.
Yeah. I was, that was one other thing I was going to say about the Avril thing, though, because
of
the
music. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I've forgotten it. It's fine. If it comes back, it comes back.
Okay.
But yeah, that happened. That other stuff happened too, sure.
You don't kind of see that happen very often with comic creators, and I also see the Neil Young thing based on his.
I totally remember what I wanted to say about the Avril Lavigne thing.
Okay, go ahead.
As stupid as that is, let's be honest, to do a comic book about Avril Lavigne, and as much flack as I took from my readers at the time.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, understandably so. I mean, you know, I was known to do this kind of really dark stuff, and, you know, and I had a certain reader base, not a large one, but it existed, and they sort of gave me a lot of flack. But, you know, when it came out, Comics Journal, which is kind of our most high-lit, you know, critical service in our industry,
right,
gave a review. My first review I ever got from Comics Journal was about the Avril Lavigne comic book, which I don't know what that says, but, And they called it the best silk purse from a sow's ear that we have ever seen.
Nice.
I want to say, if you got the balls, you should go out there and read that comic. It's not a terrible comic. It's just got Avril Lavigne in it. That's all.
I mean, you know, to me, I mean, I've done written stuff I didn't care for that got edited so much it really wasn't even, you know, mine. I mean, technical stuff and...
Sure.
You know, you get paid for it. I mean, that sometimes you got to do that.
Yeah, but I'm positing the possibility that it might be an actually good comic book.
Oh, well, in that case.
Great comic, yeah.
All right.
The only thing I have by her on my playlist is her covering Imagine. I have nothing else by her on my iTunes.
Is it a particularly good cover of Imagine? I mean, you have it in your...
You know, I bought a... It was an album of people covering Lennon songs, and...
Right. Oh, so she slipped in on you.
She did. Yeah.
That sneaky little wench.
I'm sure she's a very nice, albeit not so bright, girl.
Look at you. You're like hobnobbing with all the pop stars. You've got Avril, you've got... Didn't you say something about Madonna's production company or something?
Yeah.
Look at you. You're like a a pop star. This is like, this is what I love, all the National Enquirer stuff. Give me the dirt.
Yeah, that's what we like.
Yeah. Was there paparazzi when you went and met with Madonna's production company?
No, you don't actually get to meet with Madonna.
What?
Yeah,
you just meet with a bunch of studio execs. That was Maverick Entertainment. Maverick Entertainment no longer exists. That was back when Madonna was, she was buying so popular. Many properties, yeah.
Interesting. I want to focus a little bit on that Neil Young one. I remember reading a ton about it when it was when you were in production on it. You actually worked with him, is that right, on it?
Yeah, that's correct. That's the one instance where I got – where Neil – this is the real difference between an artist and a pop culture machine. Like Avril's really just kind of this gear at the center of a larger mechanism
that's trying to
make a lot of money for a lot of different people, not just her.
Right.
And subsequently, she really didn't care. That's why we accidentally got to make a good comic book, was because Avril didn't care. I don't think she ever saw anything that we did at all. So we were pretty free to do what we wanted. The difference between that and a real artist like Neil Young is there was no way that Neil was going to put his name on a book that he wasn't intimately a part of. So Neil and I spent a lot of time together, both on the phone and in person. And in fact, the first time I met him was backstage at the Hollywood Bowl before Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young concert. So they were all there. And I walked in there with my artist at the time, Sean Murphy, who was later replaced by Cliff Chang.
Yeah.
And that was an incredible experience, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
How surreal is that, going and meeting Neil Young backstage at the Hollywood Bowl? I mean, that's like total 60s or 70s Hollywood story.
Yeah, and according to Wikipedia, it says it was 2 weeks at number 3 on the New York Times graphic novel bestseller list.
Yeah, man, I'm a New York Times best-selling author, baby. That's how it works.
Nice.
Boom. Although I'll tell you, that doesn't mean a lot. Sales on that list are not, you know.
They're just saying, you know.
But yeah, so meeting Neil, it was so interesting. I met with him. His whole family was there. They're all lovely. His son, his daughter, his wife, Neil, and everybody else. And but he started to get really tired really early, and I thought, wow, you know, he's an old guy. He looks old. I met him after he had the brain surgery. So I was, like, concerned. He's like, I got to go take a nap before the concert. And I thought, well, you know, he's getting old. This is life. Then we went and sat down. He grabbed, like, a 15-minute nap or something, and he came out, and he was a fucking rock star, man. Dude. No, yes, like, I don't know what he does in that 15 minutes that he calls taking a nap, but he came out and he was a powerhouse.
Yeah.
So I was really, really blown away, and it was great to work with him, and he's a genuine and unique and amazing individual. I have nothing but kind things in to say about him. So
were you, like, so you were co-writing with him, or was he just editing what you were putting down on the page, or...
Well, it was, so it was based on Greendale, which is a graphic novel that Neil Young, which is a concept album, yeah, that Neil Young put out in the early part of our new century. And so he had done a movie based on that, and there had also been a rock opera. So there were all these permutations of the property. Well, I took the album and I took notes that I received from Neil Young and notes that I received from Karen Berger at Vertigo, and I sort of crafted a narrative. And he immediately greenlit me. There was a much, much more difficult time getting him getting to find an artist that he approved of. But I was the door was immediately open to me based on my very first pitch that I worked.
That's really cool. That says a lot about you, about your talent then.
What happened after that was Neil continued to be a part of the process, and that he would give me notes. I would do a pass on the script. He'd read the pass, and then he would give me more notes. He was extremely gracious about pushback from me on his notes. You know, thing to keep in mind is that Neil really hadn't read a comic book since about 1975. So there was some ideas and concepts in there that you know, I mean, he wanted to do, it's a very kind of Holmick on the nose political piece, which is
right.
The way that Neil is, you know, and so I tried to kind of mute that a little bit, but I do feel very much like Greendale is both belongs to Neil Young and to me, and Cliff Chang, actually, also visually, Cliff brought a lot to the table. It was one of the most collaborative moments that I've gotten to have with an artist.
Oh, that makes me want to actually read that.
Thanks. Well, you know, you might like it, you might not.
Well, you know, hey, that's one thing that has gotten to the point, you know, because, you know, you and I are the same age. If, you know, Wikipedia is accurate.
52 years old.
And he's getting up there. I mean, I think he's not too much younger. He's just a little bit younger than my mom and dad.
Yeah, that's right. He's of my parents' generation. Yeah.
So
I'm totally raised on his music. So
yeah, me too.
Not me, but you know, hey, I'd have to listen to some of it. I might know more of it than I thought, but you know, what I was going to say was, like, you know, all the comics that I've read over the years, especially DC, that I'm at that point now. Anything new, I'm even if I might not like it, I'm going to probably try it. So.
Yeah, nice. With Neil, it was like I've been in the room with a lot of kind of famous people trying to get projects up and rolling or whatever. Neil was the only time where I really walked into a room and I was like, you know. And I was in the room with a legitimate, real, unquestionable rock star. And everything that means, I don't mean because of his celebrity. I mean, like, what it, you know, the kind of person it takes to be a rock star. Like, a big mind, a big heart, a big imagination.
Right.
Kindness and power, too. Like, just really interesting cat.
Yeah, my dad really identified with him. And whenever I hear one of his songs, I always think of my dad.
That's nice.
There's that cover by I want to say Red Light Bandit is the name of the band. And they do that that cover of his song Old Man, which is amazing.
Nice. I haven't heard the cover, but Old Man is a phenomenal song.
You should if you get a chance. Red Light Bandit, I think, is the name of the group. And
cool.
Like, anyhow, so, got off on a tangent there.
Love it. Yeah. You like it was like a wistfulness in your voice as you began to reminisce.
When I think like Neil Young or I even think of that whole group of those four, I always think of my dad. So,
that's nice.
So you mentioned before when you were talking about the Avril comic that your fans expect something a little different from you. So it's kind of a really piss poor segue, but that's kind of, I mean, you were back to being what your fans expected when you started doing, like, Unknown Soldier again, when you were revisiting that storyline about the, you know, the war and the use of kids in war and stuff down in Africa, right?
Well, I think that, you know, that was really the only, the Avril Lavigne thing was really the only burp, because from there, you know, I went on and I did a very little red and much maligned series called The Demon Driven Out, which I actually think that if you don't have any affinity to the demon, it's actually really fun, but it's super violent. I was watching a lot of extreme Asian cinema at the time, and it's really in the work, and it's pretty much I think it's the book that guaranteed I would never work at DCU again. And then from there, you know, and I was pretty proud of it. I had a lot of fun doing it. Pop Mon did the art. He was phenomenal. And then I went, and that's from there I did Conan, and I also did my run on Swamp Thing, which is even more maligned than my Demon series. So I was alienating the mainstream. So I was probably staying true to the 5,000 readers that I had. So that's it. That's the end of that rant.
No, that's okay.
Oh, that's cool. So, no, you talk as much as you want, man.
You actually spent some time in Africa, though, before doing the Unknown Soldier stuff, right?
Yeah, that's right. I spent a month in Uganda and on the Ugandan-Sudanese border. Yeah.
Huh. Wow. That's a dangerous area.
Talk a little bit about that, would you, if you would?
Sure. You know, it's obviously it's easier to talk about if I have specific questions, but essentially
Sure.
For example, what were you doing down there, if you can talk about that?
I was researching unknown soldiers.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, they had greenlit my pitch for Unknown Soldier, and I was really, really concerned that I'd made a terrible mistake by pitching this concept of this book that would take place in Acholiland, Uganda in 2002. So I first kind of tried to get out of it, honestly, get out of doing the book. I just thought that this is wrong. These are real people. This is a real conflict. This is a super sensitive issue, and there's no way I'm gonna be able to pull this off.
It'll go away. Keep talking.
Okay. Awesome.
We have the echo every once in a while. It'll go away.
Nice. When I found out I was contractually obligated to go on with the series, I decided to go to East Africa and try to, you know, if I couldn't understand culturally what it was to be an East African and to be in this conflict, which there's no way I ever could, then at least I would just try to intellectualize that process as much as humanly possible. So I went. Yeah, I saw the IDP camps that were still in place at that time, and I ghosted the World Food Program trucks on massive food drops, and traveled to the backcountry on the back of motorcycles, interviewed child soldiers in the LRA. And this is 2007, so it's a few months after the ceasefire, and all the lieutenants had gone on to Juba for the peace talks in Sudan. So it was a fascinating time to be there politically.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So did you, I mean, wow.
That's a little bit of personal risk that you did to do that then.
Well, I want to stress a couple of things, you know, just so, you know, in the interest of you know, truth, is right. It was a few months after a ceasefire, so while there was some violence while I was there, I didn't witness any violence. I did at one time hear automatic gunfire in the distance, and what you do when you hear that is you just turn and you walk in the other direction.
Well, yeah, obviously.
It's possible. It was always a low-impact guerrilla war zone, even at its most heated, so what that means is when violence isn't everywhere, but when it breaks out in certain areas, and if you're educated and you're really following the conflict, you know kind of where the hot zones are, and you can kind of navigate them. I don't think it was as dangerous as people think it was. I think it was more emotionally intense than it was physically intense for me. Yeah, interviewing all these people, their stories are extraordinary. You're talking about a population where almost 100% of the population is experiencing some form of post-traumatic stress disorder. Everyone has seen or partaken in a murder. You know, it's two decades of conflict, the longest running, least reported conflict of my generation. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where it became intense. It's less about you fearing for your life, though there are a few scary times, but it's less about you fearing for your life and more out you grappling with your emotional ability to process the massive amount of misery that you're experiencing while you're there.
I guess they wouldn't allow, you know, a white American to get killed and all that. That would have been
well that's interesting for you to say. Actually, while I was there, a couple of white Americans did get killed. The question is like who is they? Like, who is the one who would not allow – you know what I mean? There's no
– yeah, there's no – it's not like the State Department is going to be watching over you. That's like –
yeah, precisely. There's no American army there. There was very little journalism while I was there. The only real white people there were missionaries and NGO people like Medicine Sans Frontier and people working for the United Nations, for UNICEF and stuff like that. You know, in that regard, it wasn't a safe place. I didn't have the American machine or the Western cultural machine behind me to protect me. I wasn't traveling with fellow journalists. I was traveling by myself. I wasn't with an organization. So, you know, there were some scary times. When I met up with a small group of child soldiers armed with AK-47s. You know, your first time you see a 13-year-old with an AK-47, it's scary, man. I mean, children are volatile.
Pardon me.
It was cool. You know, eventually you start to get used to the guns. That's the thing, man, is the – I don't even know how to phrase this – the banality of it. When it stops becoming an extraordinary event for you as a first worlder or someone from the developed world or a Westerner, however you want to describe it.
Right.
When it's becoming an anomaly that all these people have guns and it starts becoming banal as it did – mm-hmm. That in itself says something extraordinary about the situation. These kids hold their AK-47s like a woman holds her purse. You know what I mean? Their relationship to that gun is something that's very hard for us to understand. It's like our relationship to our iPod or something. It's like something you is so fundamentally a part of your life. And shockingly, that actually can bring some ease to somebody like me, you know, because it's just an extension of their body, and pretty soon you get used to it, you know.
Wow.
So you were able, but kind of to bring it back to the topic at hand, which is comics. I don't know how to word this, but did you do that on your own dime? I mean, did you say, you know what, I committed to do this story. I better put my head actually into this story. And you said, okay, I'm gonna go to Uganda and check this out. Or was this something that Vertigo was behind?
Actually, Karen Berger, who's a friend of mine, was concerned. I think that they would have rather had me not go. I think once I went and came back safely.
Yeah.
They were cool with it. Karen, you know, Karen and I mean, I like we're close, you know, and I think she was legitimately concerned that you get, or at this time, I don't know if this is still the case because the contracts have changed, but when you get greenlit at Vertigo, you get a $1,500 development fee. Now you get that development, you know, like everybody gets that. Jason Aaron gets that, greenlit for Scalped, et cetera, et cetera. So that bought me a plane ticket to Uganda. So in that sense, I did pay for it out of my own pocket because I could have sat at home with that $1,500 and done nothing, basically. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, read Wikipedia articles or something.
Yeah, precisely. So yeah, I did pay for it out of my own out of my own pocket, and it was a choice that I made, and there were people who tried to talk me out of it. At Vertigo, as well as my own mother.
Well, but, I have to tell you, man, that that takes balls to do that. I mean, I know I can tell that you're trying to downplay it, say it's like it's not that big of a deal, but I mean, me sitting here, I think that's a big deal. And to put that much into something that you're going to write, that's pretty impressive, I have to say.
I appreciate that. I do think that, you know, look, man,
I mean, I wasn't there, and I don't know what you experienced, so I don't know how dangerous it was, but you had no idea till you got there either, too, so.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely an intense situation. It's definitely one of the most interesting experiences I've had in my entire life, and also one of the most taxing, emotionally and physically. I will say that I believe in ethical storytelling. I believe there's an ethics to telling stories. And, I can't imagine having to or telling a story like Unknown Soldier that is centered around violence and conflict and a real culture and a real people and not going there and talking to those people, because to me that's unethical. That's like an unethical thing to do, is to sit here from my comfortable Western home and speculate on these people's lives. So I don't know any other way to do it, you know.
It is a comic book. I mean, again, I'm not trying to downplay that, because there's plenty of topical comic books, but at the end of the day, it's. I think it's really cool that you just said, you know what, yeah, it's a comic, but I'm, you know, I'm trying to tell a story set in a real life, real world area. So on that, Chris and I are 100% in agreement. Yeah.
Wow. Well, and that kind of brings up something I just got through thinking about. Have you read any of the Batwing comic that I can't think of his
Winnick.
Name. Winnick is writing.
Yeah.
It's around the same thing. Now, I don't know one way or the other if he did anything like that or not. And when I first heard about the story, and, you know, and they're doing that like on a monthly basis, how is he going to bring credibility? Now, I enjoy the story, but, I mean, if you've read it, I mean, if you feel comfortable, what do you think about that book, if you've, you know?
Yeah, generally I try to refrain from saying anything negative about other creators and stuff. I did read a single issue of Nightwing. I wasn't compelled to read further.
Yeah.
I from what I saw, I didn't see a creator or creators who felt very knowledgeable about my personal experience with the continent.
Right.
You know, that's all I can say.
Fine. That just kind of hit me when you were talking about that, because I had that same kind of qualms about it. I mean, I enjoy the book, but it is fantasy, and
sure, absolutely. You know,
and I haven't read your Unknown Soldier. I mean, I was just looking on Comixology; they got at least the first six issues. I'm definitely going to check it out. So
nice. Yeah, I don't want to compare the two, you know,
I understand. I don't want to try to put you in a spot. I just you know.
Sure. I mean,
what do you really think?
How bad does he suck? Now just tell us.
I think it was an interesting choice to, it's not Judd's fault. You know, let's put it that
way. Oh, yeah.
It was an interesting choice to make an African Batman. I mean, that was a little – I think that's a questionable creative decision to begin with.
Because, I mean, I was reading Batman Incorporated, you know, before that. He was in maybe three panels in all the eight or nine issues that they put out. So
Yeah, let's look at it this way. But it's still like the Batman concept. You know what I mean?
Exactly,
it's like,
right.
You know, let's put it this way, like – the history of Africa is the history of Western culture going over there and imposing their concepts and their ideals on the African culture. I don't know that Nightwing in Africa is much different than general colonialism, quite frankly. So
yeah, I understand what you're saying.
I kind of appropriated colonialism. I mean, when are we going to let, you know, when do Africans get to be the heroes of their own story? And I know that book had an African as its protagonist, but he's literally projecting a Western concept, a Western idea.
I just read the Zero issue where they kind of go over the origin, and he was just like a mass vigilante before that, and Batman comes to him and gives him the suit that he had designed for him.
Right.
So he wasn't even like some of the other ones that they've done that already kind of had a concept. He was just a guy with, you know, fighting sticks, and he gave him the whole thing. So, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, we could look at it as a metaphor for American foreign aid, you know, or something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
So to move on from this and kind of move back in time a little bit, you mentioned your Swamp Thing run was much maligned. Why?
You know, a couple of reasons. Some of them are my fault, and some of them I think were perceived audience issues, like what the audience perception of the Swamp Thing story should be. Mm-hmm. From my point of view, I'd never done an ongoing series before, and I had a lot to learn about that. So I did a lot of that learning in public. And so there are some pretty awkward issues of that Swamp Thing run. I also was being incredibly ambitious. I had this notion that I wanted to do poetry, comic book poetry, and I think I sometimes succeeded. And so subsequently, due to this ambition and this learning curve on my part, I think that I that some of the worst and some of the best writing of my entire career can be found in those Swamp Things. Because when you're being that ambitious and you nail it, you know, you nail it down like James Brown, as I like to say.
I like that.
When you nail it, you hit a height in your work that you could have never done if you weren't reaching for such an ambitious goal. But more likely you fail and you create a really ugly, unsuccessful comic book. So that was part of it. But another part of it was audience perception. You know, unfortunately, I think the comic book audience is a little bit, they can be a little bit stiff in how they, what they want, that they're not maybe so open to change, or to something different. And I really do think we were trying to give them something different. So we were heavily maligned at the time, and our sales pretty much plummeted from day one. What's really interesting is to see in retrospect how people have responded to it, because now whenever I hear people talk about it, everyone talks about it as this kind of progressive, interesting run. And I was really kind of – it was exciting to hear Scott Snyder talk about it before he took over Swamp Thing. So it's like – it's so interesting to see how – perception of that series has changed over time, because that was the first time I ever got really horrible reviews online. And you know, that's a big thing for a writer when a writer first starts vitriol and like hatred aimed at them for creative decisions they've made. Having said all of that, as I said before, some issues of Swamp Thing are some of the best things I've ever written. The issue I did with Jock about the dead baby is, I think, phenomenal comic book. And I got to do some, and because I was reaching for poetry in comics, I got to do things that are in my own voice in a way that I probably never will again in comics, mostly because I got chastised for it by the public.
But you got almost 3 years out of that book. I mean, that's
wow. That's a good run.
Yeah, well, you know, well, now the first nine aren't mine, so
is that right? Oh, I thought you did the whole – oh, for some reason
it was 9 through 29. I just got through seeing that.
Andy Diggle so I did 20 issues, so I did 2 years.
Okay. Sorry, for some reason I thought you were on from the beginning. Okay.
Oh, no, it's okay. I've never done more than the longest I've been on one book was 2 years and a month.
Longer than I've done anything other than the job. Well, it's funny. I mean, you should say that, you know, you're proud, you're very proud of the, and not so proud of some of it. I mean, remember reading your dissertation recently on how you write a script about puking it up on the page.
Yeah.
Is that the right terminology?
Puking my vomit pass, yeah.
A vomit pass, right.
You know, that's funny. Ian Brule said the same thing.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, nice. He used that same term. I remember that.
Well, I'm sorry, forgive my ignorance, but what has Ian done?
He's the
Boom
things. Yeah, he works for Boom. He's mostly an editor, but he's done Dracula New World Order recently.
Awesome.
It's out on Comixology. I'm trying to think what else he did.
He did a bunch of their kids books. Chip
yeah.
And DuckTales and stuff.
Yeah, DuckTales, Darkwing Duck, things like that.
Nice, awesome.
Yes.
He actually used that exact same term.
Oh, wow. Great. Cool. Yeah, I have no idea if I made that term up or if I picked it up somewhere through my life. You know, it just became part of my process and my language. Yeah.
Yeah, but if you don't try, you can't, you know, you're never, ever going to succeed at it if you don't.
Yeah, see, and that, when I try to write, I think that's what my problem is I try to have it polished before it hits the page, and I need to do more of what you're talking about is just throw it out there.
Yeah, well, you know, that's not the finished product, though, of course.
Right, exactly. I always have that problem.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
I'm
critical of myself, and it's like, oh, this looks like crap, and I never finish it.
Yeah, precisely. You know, I talk about this in the post that you guys are referring to, and I think the most important thing is to understand that there's a difference between your writer's mind and your editor's mind. Mm-hmm. And the two are incredibly valuable to make a completed piece of work, but you can't let them mingle too much. You know, in the beginning, it needs to be all writer's mind. And the writer's mind is that attitude that everything you write is awesome and brilliant, and you're having fun writing. In the editor's mind is the attitude that everything you write is crap, and that you don't, your ideas don't deserve to be out there. And you, and both of those are super important, because the editor's mind will hone your writing into something that's really, really interesting. But if you let it in too early, it can lead to, you know, creative paralysis and blockage and all that other jazz. So.
Yeah. So when you're writing, like, do you go straight to strip form? Oops, script.
I strip immediately. Once I start writing, I'm already naked at that point.
Excellent, awesome. That's totally what I was going for. Anyway, taking that image out of my head for a moment.
Okay.
I can send you a JPEG if you'd like.
No, that's okay. That would be awesome. We can post it. I mean, you know, what the hell. It's my domain. I can do whatever I want.
And Murray, it's going to cost you $9.99 an hour for that.
Excellent. Lord. Do you just, like, spit it all out on the page? Do you spit it out in script form? Or do you try to, like, craft the story first and then put it into scripty form?
The very last thing I do is format. So it's not in a script form until I feel confident that I've got a real handle on what it looks and feels like. And then I format it. Now, so basically this is my exact process is, I obviously, it percolates in my brain, it's impossible to describe what the process is before you sit down to the keyboard. Something is happening in your brain, you know you've got to write this issue, you've got your ideas, and then you sit down to the keyboard and you do, everyone's process is different and unique, right. But then I lay down a vomit pass. And my vomit pass is literally stream of consciousness typing, out of order, pits of dialogue, ideas that contradict each other, other concepts. And I literally stream for about 3 pages. This is the beginning. This is actually not even my vomit pass. This is my first, attack on the material. Right. Out of those 3 pages, maybe there'll be one idea, one concept that's valuable to me. So I'll extract that concept that I've revealed to myself through the stream of conscious writing, and then I start to do the vomit pass. And the vomit pass is all the scenes in order, some fleshed out, some not, whatever, and I just lay it all down. And it's clumsy and it's ugly, and there's, you know, I'm not worried about grammar or formatting. And then I'll take another pass on that vomit pass, then another. So I'm doing 3 passes on that vomit pass now. By now, it should be pretty fleshed out thematically, but also, like, the actions, the themes, the dialogue should be pretty fleshed out. And then I slowly start thinking about it as a comic book. And that takes a lot of extraction, right? I'm pulling out a lot of stuff because comics do some things well and some things not so well. So I'm eliminating what doesn't work for me as a comic book. And once I've done that, basically through 3 passes, then only then do I begin to format. So a big part of this process is just spending time with your material so that it can kind of seep into your unconscious where the really interesting decisions can get made. And that's process. I will say this. So I was in Pittsburgh and I was talking to a very, very close friend of mine who I adore dearly, who's a huge name in this industry. And I'm not going to say his name because I don't know how proud he'd be of what I'm about to say. But somebody I adore, and he was telling me how much he wrote this month. And I was in absolute awe. And I said, how long does it take you to write a script, a 22-page script? He said, 6 hours.
Whoa.
That off. And then he looked at me and he was like, how long does it take you? And I was like, well, it takes me 2 weeks, man. It takes me 2 weeks to write 22 pages.
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever works for you, I just don't think what comes to mind is going to be the best idea. So I'm always struggling for something deeper.
And do you don't dispose of any of those, the stuff that you put out initially, though? I mean, you kind of hang on to that and maybe use it somewhere else, or what?
Oh, no, I throw away most of it, yeah.
And really? Mostly, okay.
If it's a good idea, it'll stick with me, and it'll reemerge on its own, you know what I mean? Like, it'll come out again, and I'll just be like, oh, yeah, that works here. But no, I, I, uh, I probably write 3 pages for every page of material you see.
Wow, writer, you hand cramps. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my hands are gonna be disgusting when I'm older.
Yeah. No. I mean, that's the kind of, I love hearing that kind of stuff because, you know, I'm trying to do writing myself and the fiction stuff. I've done a lot of technical stuff, different things, a book and whatever. And it's always, I always like to hear how somebody else does the process and just trying to improve me, you know, how I do it. So, but yeah, that's really good.
Yeah, awesome. Well, you know, if, like I said, I want to stress everybody's process is different, and writing isn't a mechanical thing; it's an organic thing.
Oh,
so,
yeah, absolutely.
So you have to be careful. But if anybody's interested, or if they think they would help, it would help. You know, you guys mentioned a moment ago there's a post on my website called "How I Start and Eventually Finish a Story" that covers a lot of the broad strokes about how I write, and maybe that would help somebody. So,
yeah, I just hunted it down and found it. I'll post it in the show notes.
I like the choose your own adventure.
Page
put in there.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really good stuff.
And flashbacks. I actually want to grab up some of those books for my kid, have her read them.
I started going through Choose Your Own Adventure covers for that post, and eventually found the satirical ones, which were way better. But the idea for using Choose Your Own Adventure images, I went back and I found all the – I mean, I totally had these flashbacks. I had read all – I think I read every Choose Your Own Adventure book when I was a kid. It was awesome.
I read a lot of those too. They're on Facebook, actually. So I remember I signed up for it or whatever, so I get like a post from them every once in a while. It's pretty fun.
Nice. Do they still publish them?
I think they do, yeah. They actually have a Facebook page.
Nice.
Not like they couldn't, I mean, for goodness sakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go to page 14 if you want to kiss the girl. Yeah. So, Harbinger.
Yes, Harbinger. Sir.
Yeah, I was going to get to that.
Well, I think we should get to it. Yeah. We're there. So, are you watching a lot of kung fu movies while you're writing this?
I am not, although I have seen a tremendous amount of kung fu movies in my past. But is there a reason why you're asking me?
The him going to the kung fu school was what it felt like.
That's interesting. I should say that all the references to their education are actually from the samurai, the way the samurai were trained. So it's Japanese.
That sounded familiar when I was reading it. I couldn't put my finger on it.
Yeah, yeah. It's more kind of like a Japanese code of honor and ethics than it is kung fu stuff. However, you're right. Like, I had never thought about that. But thematically, it's very much like, you know, young impatient student goes to kung fu school. Yeah.
Kung fu school. You'll have to forgive me because I've totally got my DC blinkers on, which sometimes lets in a little bit of Marvel, but I'm completely clueless about the Valiant stuff. So give me, like, what's Harbinger about?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, yeah. So Harbinger is about a young kid named Peter Stanchik. He's on the streets. He's a runaway. He spent most of his life in a mental institution being super drugged up, and he's addicted to pills, mostly because at the institution they kept him doped up to keep what he has, which is this almost hyper psychic abilities in check. It's beyond psychic abilities and telekinetic abilities. He later finds out there's a word for it called psionics, but up until this point he's basically just a runaway with these powers. And they've sort of haunted him, and they've sort of been a burden to him. And one night, one very important night of his life, he's approached by a man who has the same abilities, only much more stronger. And this man is not a poor runaway kid. This man is what appears to be a 45-year-old multi-billionaire in charge of one of the largest conglomerate corporations in the history of the world. And he brings in Peter to sort of teach him control and restraint, because Peter has made, by the end of issue one, several very, very poor decisions.
Yeah. Oh, that's true.
And a very, really creepy one, too.
Yeah.
Some decisions that have many that some readers have suggested we might not be able to redeem him from. I hope that's not true, because I do intend on making this a redemption story. But
yeah, see, that just for a second, the story is really about him, though. It's not about the other guy, the billionaire.
I don't know. What do you think so far?
Like I said, I literally just read number four today.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, it seems like it switches. It's about both of them and maybe how they interact with each other, maybe.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, basically what we're doing is we're trying, you know, we wanted, there's a lot of concepts we want to discuss here about conflict in modern culture, right? One is the haves and the have-nots. Mm-hmm. One is the generational conflict. You know, the baby boomers are the generation that have been on the stage and commanded the most resources longer than any other generation in the history of the species. No generation lived as long. No generation took as long to retire. So in a lot of ways, there's an upset in the balance of the way we have perceived civilization up until this moment, where the youth take power at a younger age than they are now. Now you got people still living at home at like 25 years old, 28 years old. No offense to anybody who may be on this podcast.
No, I was 26 when I left, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, the boomer generation and the children who emerged from that generation, this has never happened before. So we want to discuss that sort of generational gap. I'm very curious, too. I've always been interested in exploring the struggle between the collective and the individual. That's one thing that this country, America, has always battled with. The collective is necessary and important because there's strength in numbers. The individual is necessary and important because inspiration and imagination comes from the individual. So there's constant struggle between those two concepts, and I hope that's part.
Did you build it, Josh? Did you build it?
Sorry. Exactly. So the book wants to explore all this stuff, and to do that, we're going to have to be more than just about one character.
Well, that makes sense why it's that way then. I can see that then.
Yeah. And so, you know, but Peter is, I mean, I guess you would identify, in a black and white world which the book is trying to subvert, mm-hmm. you would identify Peter as the protagonist, and you would identify Harada as the antagonist. But I hope it's going to be more complex than that.
Oh, yeah. No, the lines are already blurred.
Yeah.
As far as
I can. At this point, there doesn't seem to be any bad guys in your book. I mean, I know you introduced the government angle.
You know, it's funny you say that, because to me, it's the other way around.
Really?
Everybody's a bad guy?
Well, I wouldn't say bad as in, like, Dr. Doom bad, but they're more on the bad tilt than they are on the good tilt. I guess I could be more accurate. You know, their compass is a little bit off north.
I think that, you know, I don't want to spoil anything in 4 that no one has read yet, but I think that the events at the end of 4 definitely suggest that the person who is the most altruistic and the person who strives the most for a kind world is also the one who's willing to do the most horrible things.
Yeah,
and the
person, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, and the person who pretty much makes terrible decisions and is a little bit of a douchebag all the time is the one who ultimately struggles to be as good as he can be.
Yeah,
so
that's what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a platoon with the two sergeants. Okay.
Yeah, it is. It's a yeah, that's right.
that's the image that when you were saying that's what popped into my head was wow. God, I can't remember the Willem Dafoe and Tom
Ellis,
Baron.
Right? The Willem Dafoe or as Ellis the Tom Baron.
Yeah.
I forget, yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember what Barringer cared, but that's what I was kind of sensing is that, you know, that the relationship of, you know, being torn one way or the other, and which is going to bring him back to reality. Okay, sorry.
I'm really enjoying this book.
So, to Murray's question, and then maybe this is what he was actually driving at, is none of us really have exposure to pre 2012 Valiant. Is there any relationship with your current take on Harbinger with the old Harbinger?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you don't have to read the old stuff to dig what we're doing. You know, we're not going to call back to the old series in ways that you absolutely have to know about. But, you know, the story, the characters, they're all kind of cribbed.
Hello?
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 All right, technical difficulties aside. Okay, so.
All right, we're back.
Pre 2012 Valiant versus current 2012 Valiant. We don't necessarily, I mean, have to have the previous ones, but, and that's kind of where I lost it.
Okay, I was wondering. I rambled forever.
We got some of it, but I think what you were saying was how the characters were. I think the word you used was scraped, maybe, or gleaned from those.
I think I cribbed it from.
That was the word, cribbed.
Basically, the original Harbinger, the DNA, is very much in this book, and so much so that we're getting very favorable reviews from all the old Valiant fans. I don't want to generalize everybody. I'm sure somebody's not happy, but so far it seems like everyone's pretty happy.
Please everybody.
Yeah, that's right. But I don't think it's actually it doesn't affect your enjoyment of the book, I think, reading the old Harbinger.
That's cool.
So in the – I know that – and again, you're talking to a non-pre-2012 Valiant readers, but they were part of one big universe eventually in the old Valiant.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that's what we're heading toward. In fact, we were just 2 weeks ago all up in New York City together, Fred Van Lintie, Robert Vendetti, Dwayne Straczynski, and I, with the editorial group – of Valiant, and we were basically figuring out the next 6 months of the universe. So we're going for it. We're gonna, you know, look, the truth of the matter is there's only been two sustained times in the history of comic books where shared universes succeeded. Mm-hmm. And that was DC and Marvel.
Right.
Valiant got the closest. The original Valiant got the closest to being the third time that succeeded. And had they lasted more than a decade, you know, I think we could have viewed it as a bona fide success.
Yeah,
we're gonna go for it again. I mean, can we do this? Can we mm-hmm. can we spend the next 10 years on a shared universe and get enough of the market share to justify our continued existence?
Well,
see,
I will tell you that. I mean, I've read everything that you guys have put out so far.
Nice.
And I took a chance on a couple of them, and I've got started with the. I'm all digital now, but it looks like number 5 of Exo Manowar's out. Oh wait, I've already read it. Anyway, I really like what they're doing, and you know, the thing that made me balk was the $3.99 price.
Sure.
But the stuff that I've read so far has been better than some of the stuff I'm reading at $2.99. So, I mean, I think you're succeeding, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And we were talking about the page counts, I think last episode. And, you know, they're real big page counts for the money, too. So, I mean, it's worth, at least in my opinion, and I'm sure Caleb will probably agree, that it is worth the money.
Oh, yeah, I'm a cheapskate, so.
Yeah.
Well, I'll say this, man. I got to be honest. You know, first of all, it's such a curious thing in this industry. For 22 pages of original art, you know, $3 to, you know, it's still pretty good price. I know that's not really as competitive with other things like
you can
a game for that price and get 60 hours of gameplay, you know.
Right. Well, I think it's because as readers we have been trying to force us into telling us what's good and what isn't, and Marvel's the biggest one about it because, you know, you look at the stuff they put out for $3.99 and their page count goes anywhere down from 18 up to, you know, whatever. They just put out however many pages they feel like, you know.
Yeah.
they don't really care, and they charge the same amount.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you're putting out a comic at $3.99 and it's worth the money, then that's fine. I'll pay that money.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the truth of the matter is all of our first issues, I think the whole Summer of Valiant, the first four issue, first four number ones, we all went over 22 pages. In fact, I think mine to 36 pages. Yeah.
Absolutely. So, yeah, number one, I got it right here.
Are Shooter or Layton any part of this?
Just out of curiosity. No, there was an attempt before we came on board. This is the second time that the people who currently own the Valiant brand and all the properties therein. This is the second time they've launched. They launched a few years back, and Shooter was part of that launch.
I remember that.
I don't know the details, but it went south really fast.
I liked his Templar stuff that he did, which I didn't realize that was part of the original Valiant stuff.
And I think there was actually some issues with him going to Dark Horse to do the Solar stuff. I think that's where the split occurred.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
I like that. I mean, I'm actually a shooter fan, so that's why I asked.
It depends on what it is, but yeah.
Hey, don't knock Legion. Do not knock his last Legion run, okay?
I won't. I just remember some of the stuff I already said it happened, but, you know.
You made some comments, I don't know whether it was Facebook or interview or something like that, that with this, you know, with what looks like to be, it's going to be a success with Valiant, it's really showing that, you know, Kirkman is right, that you don't have to tie your wagon to DC or Marvel to succeed in this industry nowadays. Is that becoming more and more a comfortable comment for you?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I do believe that Kirkman was oversimplifying the issue a little bit.
I think he was, but yeah.
Yeah, Kirkman is an outlier. The odds of you coming out of nowhere and becoming Robert Kirkman are extremely, extremely rare. He's a phenomenal entrepreneur, and he's a unique person in this generation of our entire industry. I think right now the way the game is set up, you really still need to sort of build your name at a bigger publisher. And so really, I think the cycle right now is start doing independent stuff, get noticed by one of the bigger publishers, mm-hmm. get into the bigger publishers for an amount of time that to kind of build an audience, and then go back to the independent stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's the route that you need to take to have a successful, sustained career in comics right now.
I think the perfect example of that is Sam Humphries.
Oh, yeah, I know Sam. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
You know Sam? Oh, that's cool.
I know Sam pretty well, yeah.
Yeah, well, I'd like to get him on the show. I forget what it was. I've read two or three things that he wrote and didn't know it until after, and I saw an interview with him on iFanboy. And he had this plan, and he went, and, you know, he's doing the Ultimates, a bunch of Ultimate stuff.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Started off with that one shot, Our Love Is Real, and I wish I could remember what. It's either Higher Earth or Extermination that he does for Boom that I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
I forget which one it is.
Yeah, Sam is great, man, and that's exactly right. And Sam's gonna say, you know, and he's gonna go back to creator owned when he needs to, when it suits him. Mm-hmm. I will say that right now there's a contraction happening in the industry. Mm-hmm. I think the time is coming when Marvel and DC's almost desperate attempts to keep their readership buoyant and high are gonna backfire. I think already I hear a lot readers are sort of responding poorly to. Or just have fatigue to endless crossovers, endless.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, in that sense, this is a prime time for creator-owned material and independent publishers and smaller publishers like Valiant to step in. So, I think this is a really unique time in comics. And while it looks scary if you look at the sales, and it looks scary if you look at the contraction happening, actually, this is an opportunity for us to refashion the industry in a way that's more interesting. We need to go back to being punk rock, you know, and stop being the corporate shill that we've been for the last
time. There you go.
Yeah, but CBGB's closed, so.
That's all right. The spirit lives on.
Yeah. No, I agree with you totally, and I think going digital is what's really made it more possible than ever. I mean,
I think the digital thing is a super complex issue, but in the end, I do think it's gonna save us. I really do.
Well, I mean, because I know, well, I mean, okay, from my experience, my little experience with publishing comics, you know, I took the class at Comics Experience, and a bunch of us got together, which everybody listening to this podcast has heard this a billion times, but, you know, it took getting all of us together, you know, like a grand out of my money just to get it going, and then, you know, the digital publisher Kablam screwed us over, and we're probably not going to get any whatever little money that we did get is probably gone. And you know, and I doing digital, it's just easier in a way. You know, it might not cost any less, but it's just easier to get done.
Yeah, absolutely, and easier to distribute. You
know? Yeah, absolutely.
So you've got Harbinger going on. So you said earlier it takes you 2 weeks to put together a script. Does that mean that Harbinger is it for you for the time being, or do you have other stuff going on either with Valiant or elsewhere or outside the industry even?
I've got I'm looking forward to making some time to get back to doing I did an animation pitch last year at Disney that went very far through the process and then didn't emerge out the other side as an actual TV show. I'd like to get back to some of that. But right now, my plan really is to just do the Valiant stuff, do it the best I can, and leave some space open for some creator-owned work. So I'm currently working with an artist named Camilla DiRico on a series of graphic novels that is going to be called Helmet Girls, and you're going to see us kind of moving toward that very soon. I just started the script, and I'm sending 40 pages of it tomorrow to the artists and the freelance editor we hired to edit us. And I'm excited about that. I've got coming out sometime pretty soon. I wrote the second volume, not the first, but the second volume in the new Dark Crystal trilogy that Archaea Press is putting out.
Yeah, I just saw that on
very
Amazon.
Cool.
Actually.
Yeah, and I'm pretty proud of that script, and I'm excited for that to come out. Alex Shakeman is the artist, and he's beautiful, beautiful work, beautiful person. What else do I got going on right now? Really, that's it, and the Valiant stuff. I'm keeping it pretty low-key, you know. I'm for the first time, I spent most of my career scrambling to get as much work as possible, and in doing so, I sometimes compromise jobs that I had lined up, and I don't want to do that anymore. I want to be, got my paying gig with Valiant, and I really believe it's time for me to get my own voice out there. The last time I did creator-owned work was Violent Messiahs, and that was 10 years ago, and I'm a much better and much different writer now than I was then, so I think it's time for me to go back to that.
You've mentioned Camilla a couple times in our conversation, so
yeah.
I'm checking out her page right now. My goodness, wow.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome, this comic we're doing, yeah.
Wow, she's
that's really cool.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, you'll have to send me that link too, and we'll put it in the show notes.
Keep us, yeah, I will actually. Yeah, keep us totally, you know, in the loop here. If you want to talk, when this stuff starts, you know, getting out there, if you want to talk about it a little bit, we'd be very happy to have you, you know, you or Camilla, if she wants to come on and talk about it. If you guys want to come and talk about it together, that's cool too.
Awesome, sweet. Yeah. Thanks, man. I appreciate the offer. You know, you and I, Caleb, we're Facebook friends, so we can always communicate there. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
Facebook is the reason why my high school class never had reunions in the last 5 years.
Oh, really? They just got it all.
Who needs to meet in person when we can trade all our bullshit stories online? So.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, precisely. Especially, you know, I mean, do you really want to meet all those high school people again? You can kind of, with Facebook, you can kind of, you know, you can do a reconnaissance on them, make sure.
Exactly. Yeah.
See who you actually really want to see and who you really don't give a crap about anymore.
Yeah.
Without even having to put on the camo and the face paint, I can spy on them. It's cool.
Yeah, there you go. Perfect.
Exactly.
I don't have to be a stalker anymore. Good.
Oh, I'm so good that Facebook like filled that niche for you, that stalker niche.
Well, it was getting creepy.
Well. We weren't going to say anything to you.
I know. Well. You weren't supposed to notice me, Chris. Well, damn, I mean, it's so good to talk to you. It really is. I mean, I know that, you and I trade notes every once in a while, but I just, you know, I don't get to L.A. ever, so.
Yeah, it's been ages, absolutely, man.
So you've got to come to the Phoenix Con.
I'd love to. I mean, yeah, sure. Have them invite me. I'll come.
I'll be able to come this time. I don't know.
I know Tone was going to make it a couple times, and he flaked out and came up with various excuses, but Tone kind of way.
Yeah, I haven't been there in ages, so I'd love to come, yeah.
I will pass your name on to them. I know that since Valiant has actually got some really good buzz going on, getting one of you guys, especially since you're local, out here would be cool.
Yeah, I'm totally down for it. Oh, that reminds me. I think we said this when it wasn't recording, but my Harbingers 1 and 2 just went to reprint. So they're
that's right.
Covers, so.
Congratulations on that. That's a good thing.
It is a good thing. I mean, it probably means they were under-ordered originally, but that's cool. You know, no hard feelings between me and...
Hey, I mean, in this market, you know, that's not surprising.
Yeah, but that's all right, though. I'm really excited about it. One of the new covers is absolutely stunning, so I'm excited to get those out. So if people haven't read Harbinger yet and they're having trouble finding issues 1 and 2, they're coming your way again.
We will pimp it. We will pimp it on our page. We'll pimp it on the site, and we will when the show goes live.
I will do some SEO search engine magic on this post for this episode too, to try to get as much exposure as possible.
Cool, I love it.
So, I absolutely 100% appreciate you making the time. Apologies for the scrambling. That's 100% all on me. All on me. So.
Yeah, it's all right. I had made this time free anyway, so when it all worked out, it was great. All
right. Well, yeah, I appreciate it too.
Pleasure.
Schedule around and everything. So, I think we. One more thing before we go. If you have time to read comics, what are you reading right now?
Ooh, good question.
That is a good question. Catches me out a little bit in the cold. I don't know how much time.
Sorry about that.
Oh, that's all right. That's what makes it a good question, sir. Yeah. Right now, honestly, I'm reading a bunch of comics that I picked up from new creators at Pittsburgh. So I was just at the Pittsburgh Con. So I'm reading a bunch of comics from people that, you know, I'd met through Facebook and had communicated with me and went and tossed a couple of bucks their way. Right now, you know, honestly, I was a huge fan of Scout. And so that's not something I read anymore for obvious reasons. I was a big fan of, I was sort of in Vertigo at that period when DMZ and Northlanders and Scout was going on and The Unwritten. And so I love all those guys and I became very attached to their books. Apart from that, though, I'm mostly a graphic novel reader. So yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, I just finished Big Questions, which was amazing, I'm a little out of the closet. I read more books these days than comics.
Yeah, well, that's cool. That makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't know how. I mean, given how much is out there, I have to almost force myself some weeks to actually read comics because I actually want to read prose. I've just finished the. A biography on the Smothers Brothers, and it's like,
interesting.
That was so much more fun than and gratifying than most of the comics that I read last month. So,
cool. Yeah, you know, it's so hard with only 20 this kind of arbitrary 22 page count. Mm-hmm. What I want when I come to a reading experience is a lot of kind of thematic and dramatic meat, and that's not easy in 22 pages. That's why I try to find just the right balance between stuffing my issues with content but not making them too crowded, you know, so that the images can breathe. And it's hard. It's hard. I don't know. Yeah. A lot of and that makes it an unsatisfying reading experience, which is why I'm almost strictly graphic novels now.
You know? Oh, no. Yeah. I mean, look at one of your issues, and if just at first glance, like, oh, my God, there's so many words in here, but – The words are really good.
I agree totally. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, hopefully I leave room for nice images and stuff.
Squeeze in the art between your word balloons, so don't worry about it.
Yeah, I mean, the way that they're, and I think they're not only good words, but they're deeper words. It gives your characters a little bit more depth than you see sometimes.
Nice. So, yeah, cool.
Big words more than two syllables. Appreciate that.
Yeah, that's good stuff. You like
nice.
That.
Awesome.
So
I think I had to look up one of the words you used once in one of those, like, oh shit, I gotta bring out my dictionary. So.
I remember I read a book like that and it's like every other page I had to do that. It's like maybe I should wait. Read this later. So
what the? I'm dying to know what that word was, but I'm sure this.
Don't press me on it. I'll have to dig out the issues. I don't remember whether it was in one or two, but it was one of your references. Like, I gotta look that up and find out.
Hilarious. I don't know if that's a good. It's one thing to be, you know, smart. It's another thing to, like, alienate the audience. So hopefully we're not doing that.
You know? Well, no. Certain characters do it, so, you know.
Right.
Yeah, and it wasn't like you – it didn't feel like you were patronizing with the statement. I can tell you that, right? It was
awesome. Good. That's good to know.
It was organic. How about that?
That's perfect. That's all I want to be is organic.
Yeah. So one other question that popped in my head. I mean, how did you get into writing? Was this just something that, I mean, did you study to do this or?
I didn't. I've never studied to do it. I kind of wish I had. I think maybe it would have accelerated my growth a little bit.
Yeah, I know what you mean there.
Yeah. No, I just always did it my whole life. I just always told, always just wrote stories. I don't know. I don't remember when I didn't write stories. Most of my stories when I was really young were me unconsciously plagiarizing whatever I was reading.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
You know, that's a big part of learning, you know. So I don't know. It's just something I always did.
That's cool.
I think I was also very visually oriented. So I think that's why comics was a natural fit. I couldn't draw, but I was very much into sort of painting with words for a long time. So
Did you read comics as a kid?
I did. Yeah. Absolutely. I was always into comics. I never ever imagined or intentionally pursued doing it as a career until I accidentally fell into it and then decided to take it seriously. But I always read them. Huge reader of. The first comics when they were coming out, like the imprint first comics, which had Badger and all that stuff. I used to love that stuff.
Oh yeah, I've started picking up
American Flag
older stuff. Yeah.
American
like
Flag,
that.
And I've been really fortunate to be able to get to know at a few shows Howard Chaykin, who was a big hero of mine when I was a kid with American Flag, and
that's awesome.
He's hilarious. Jesus Christ, that guy, man. He's got an opinion on absolutely everything.
I'd like to meet him, too.
We just squeezed him into two different shows, a conversation. We talked about Black Kiss briefly with Ian Brill last
time. Oh, yeah, we did.
Nice, yeah.
Yeah, it's been Black Kiss 2 being banned everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was a big reader. You know, I was that generation who brought Watchmen to school as it was coming out monthly. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, it took me a long time to read that. I didn't read it when it was out.
Yeah.
I don't know why? But I remember buying the trade for it. I was probably maybe 20 years ago. So I was in my 20s at least before I read it.
Yeah. You know, I will never forget. I was buying it as it was coming out, and
I imagine that was pretty awesome.
I will never forget the issue where Dr. Manhattan goes to Mars and he conflates the timeline and sort of experiences things simultaneously. It's one of the single best comic book issues ever written, in my opinion. And I remember buying it at the store and then walking to the park with my bag of comics and sitting under a tree and reading that comic book.
Wow, sweet.
And that might have been a fundamental moment for me as far as... Yeah. You know, as far as who I've become as an adult, that was a big, big experience for me. Yeah,
I could see that. There's been some Batman issues that have done that same kind of thing to me.
Yeah, and you know, I was reading Batman when Bray Fogle was on it, and Alan Grant.
That I was reading when it came out.
Absolutely. Yeah, every generation does this. We're all like, our generation was better and all that shit.
Yeah.
But it was, man. You know, we were at this editorial retreat doing all this stuff, and all the writers are my age. We're all 40, 41, and the editors are younger than us. And one of the editors, who's a really funny, great, fantastic guy, starts talking about how much he loved the first Star Wars prequel.
And we're all, God.
We're all just kind of groaning, you know, and he said straight up, just being honest with us, he was like, dude, I was 10 years old And, you know, and I at first that felt like a legitimate excuse. You're like, sure, when you're 10, you know, you like a
you
bunch
of – You don't know any better. Yeah, yeah.
But then it dawned on me, and I said, man, you know, when I was 10 years old, The Empire Strikes Back came out.
Yeah.
Your generation got screwed, man.
Yeah, they did. See, that's – you know, we were talking before we started the actual podcast, but, you know, I'm going to be moving in with my – living with my sister a little bit till I get a new place, and I asked her if she's got 3 kids, 9, 6, and 3. None of them have seen any of the Star Wars movies.
Nice.
So it's like I get to show that to them for the first time, so it should be interesting.
Oh, that's awesome! I was 6 years old when the first Star Wars movie came out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Remember though, the same year that Star Wars came out, King Kong came out. So
that's true.
Hold on. You mean the King Kong with Jeff Bridges?
The King Kong with Jeff Bridges.
Yeah. That movie's awesome. I don't know what you're getting at here.
I remember seeing that at the movie theater, yeah.
I did too. I actually saw that before I saw Star Wars, so.
Oh, well, that might have something to do.
I wasn't living in the country, so we got what we could we watched what we could get our hands on in English, so.
Oh, wow.
I cried at the end of King Kong. I didn't
cry. That was sad, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Sad stuff.
Charles Grodin is the bad guy. For
goodness. That's right. Isn't he?
I haven't seen that movie, and you know, I mean, I'm probably defending an indefensible act of creativity. But I remember it being awesome.
Well, your memory is tainted somewhere along the line.
Well, anyway, I think we've covered everything. We don't want to keep you too long, so.
Josh, man, it's great catching up. I'm gonna definitely reach out to the Phoenix Con people, tell them we have a local Valiant writer, which can drag you out here from LA for a couple days.
I love it. I totally come, man. Absolutely, and I really appreciate this, guys. It's been fun.
Oh yeah, well, good. No, thank you for coming on and you know, being invited twice and short notice tonight and everything.
Shut up, man.
Oh, sorry. But anyway, you know, that's all behind the curtain stuff. But yeah, it was good having you on. You've been a great guest.
Awesome. Thank you so much, guys.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks, Josh.
All right.
Cheers. Take care.
Good.
Bye, Chris. Bye, Murray.
See ya.
Bye.
All right. So.
All right. That was good.
Stop pointing out the secret behind the show. Are you still out there, Josh? Just have no idea. Yes. Nope. He's gone.
He's gone.
Okay.
He's gone.
Right. That was cool. Another well-done interview.
Yeah,
two down. Two down, two to go.
Yes. And so, yeah, so that kind of wraps it up for this episode. And you can always...
Recording.
What?
We're still recording, okay.
That's right.
What?
Anyway, la 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 la. Yes.
Yeah, well, okay, I can edit that out. Don't worry about it. Nobody listens that far. Once the talent leaves, they turn it off anyway. You know that.
Oh, yeah? Then they're going to miss the big revelation.
Oh, yeah. anyway, you can contact us at podcast@tellsfromthelongbox.com.
What? You're pregnant?
What? Let us know our feedback or comments or tell us how crazy we are. Tell us.
Name the new baby.
You're killing me. Anyway. Oh, Lord. Facebook page. That's where all the action happens, boys and girls. You need to go on there and check it out. And, you know, internet fist fights and rage and all kinds of good stuff. And, like, just today, we have a post by one of our members, How to Write an Event Comic 101, and it just goes on. Nice 4 points, I think. There might be 5 or 6, but anyway. That's just great info right there. So that's about it here for us this week, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye.
And we're out. Now we're really out.
See, normally when I say bye-bye, I figure that's the end, but
I guess not.
Well, we have the email and stuff. I could cut it out. It doesn't matter.
No, leave it. It's funny.
Oh, I can look like a big dummy.
No, that's all right.
Me too. So we're gonna have Josh and Johnny on Sunday then.
Sounds good.
That's fine. We can do that.
Did you guys wanna try and get that get Michael from Boom on like Saturday or something and just power all this shit out for
if,
and get a couple?
If you want to do that, yeah, that's fine. I'll make time.
Yeah, I should be around. I think.
I'll have my crappy ass job and.
Okay, I'll reach out to him and see what Saturday looks like.
Okay, that's cool.
Sure.
All right.
Okay. Yep. Sounds good.
All right, I'll see you later, man.
See ya.
Okay, guys, you have a good night.
All right, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.